The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
An on-time splashdown. Oh, looks like we're getting our next crew member here. That is none other than Sunny Williams. Big smile, big waves. She, like her other crew members, now will be assisted onto the mobility aid.
A mobility aid, of course, because they have been in zero gravity for 9 months. That is Sunny Williams and Butch Wilmore making their return from the International Space Station, splashing down off the coast of Florida this week. I'm joined by a man who has commanded the International Space Station, as well as having flown pretty much every fighter jet that you can point a stick at, for the Canadian Air Force Commander, Chris Hadfield. Chris, how are you?
I'm well, Anton. How are you keeping?
I'm very good. How vertical are your elbows these days?
Well, yeah, it's a good time to keep your elbows up when your team's under attack. Absolutely.
I want to talk to you about that and implications for things like military purchases and all the way to all of that stuff in a second. Before that, though, 9 months on the International Space Station, having commanded it yourself, what would that experience have been like for them? How unpleasant was it? What's it like to live in that thing for an extended period of time?
Oh, it's the purpose of being an astronaut. It's the ultimate reward, is to be able to stay an extended period on the space station. So Sonny and Butch were overjoyed. They served the human space program great. Sonny worked as the commander of the spaceship for almost 6 months while she was up there. The two of them did some spacewalks. They helped with 200 experiments on board. And both of them, in the week before they came back, said they hoped they'd get a chance to do another long-duration flight in space. So even though originally they were on a flight testing a new vehicle that could have gone very short, they were both happy and lucky to be able to stay a long time.
It's interesting to hear you characterize it that way, because much of the discourse around it had been that this was a rescue mission and that they were stranded. That's not how you or they would see it.
Well, most of the discourse around it had no idea what they were talking about. And if you actually listen to Sonny and Butch and NASA, they said exactly the truth the entire time. Sonny and Butch had a ride home every single day that they were up there, so they could leave anytime they needed to, and they're where they wanted to be. That's what professional astronauts do. So it was just an invention of the media, and it was fun to make fun of Boeing, and so that's what people did. But it wasn't the truth.
It was also an invention to some extent of Elon Musk, because he was pushing the suggestion that he could have sent a SpaceX rescue mission, but for political reasons, Joe Biden didn't want to do it and all of the rest of it. How unusual is it to have the man who is responsible for the vast majority of crewed and cargo space flights in the world effectively arguing with the astronauts on those flights?
A SpaceX vehicle has been up there the entire time. The vehicle that they came home on was a SpaceX vehicle, and it's been up there since September. There was one that was there prior to that they could have come home in if they'd had to. So, you know, there's a difference between the practicality of what's happening and politics. And often it's kind of fun for the media to exaggerate one and ignore the other.
Talk to us a bit, Chris, then, about what the role of commander is for the International Space Station, because I think people can understand it in respect of the flying part of the mission, whether it be space shuttle or anything else, getting there. But once you're there, what do you have to do as commander?
Well, it's the same as the commander of an aircraft carrier. I mean, you still report to the chief of naval staff and chief of defense staff or whatever your particular country is. But you're responsible for the lives primarily on board. And the health of the vehicle, and then all of the things that you're trying to do, all of the hundreds of experiments on board. And you make all the day-to-day decisions. And what you're really there for are for when things go wrong. You know, like when I was commanding the space station, when all the computers failed and we lost communications with Earth and started tumbling through space and had to rescue the whole ship, or the time that we developed a huge ammonia leak and started spewing the main coolant of the space station out into space. That's what the commander's role is to be ready for those things with a crew of people that can deal with it. And then try and hopefully keep everybody alive, keep the vehicle healthy, and then get all the job done that the mission is demanding.
Only you, Chris, could say the words when the computers fail and you're in the dark tumbling through space, or when your main fuel is leaking out into the atmosphere, and describe it in the same way as you say when a bus arrives 3 minutes late. Do you feel no panic in these moments? Is there not even the tiniest bit of fear about the whole dying thing?
Well, panic and fear come when you don't know what you're doing and you're not ready for things that might happen. And it's an extremely natural state. And when I'm faced with things where I don't know what I'm doing and I'm out of control, then sure, I feel fear and panic. But what I try and do, rather than just run around fearful and panicky all the time, is get ready for the things that might go wrong. And as a commander of a space station, that's your job. That's your responsibility. And so I served 21 years as an astronaut, getting ready for those things to go wrong so that I wouldn't just be a panicky, scared commander. And I apply it to my entire life as well. What are the things that are probable to go wrong? And how can I use the quiet time of my life to actually be ready for those things so that I don't live all stressed and tensed up and getting an ulcer and, you know, worrying myself. I'd much rather go through life ready than go through life panicked.
So in whatever then about the adrenaline rush, how do you actually solve the spinning through space with no computers problem? What did you have to do in that instance?
We had trained with the fact that there's a very primitive software program that we actually kept on a disk on board, and it has the funny name of Mighty Mouse. And what we did was we went and found where Mighty Mouse was stowed in this sort of this folder of old CD-ROMs or whatever they were. And, yeah, it was a CD-ROM, and put it into the computer, and it gives you a sort of very primitive raw control of the fundamental systems of the space station so that then you could start getting the ship back under control and then get it in an attitude where it's pointed the right way so that you can start communicating with Earth and that the solar arrays are pointed at the sun so you're recharging your batteries and then just start working your way up from there. But the first thing is, it's just like in an airplane or even a car down the motorway. The first thing is get the vehicle back under control, fly the thing and drive the thing, and then deal with all the subsidiary systems after that. And it took several days before we were back to normal operations after that.
You mentioned it being similar to an airplane. The last time that I spoke to you, we sort of went through the list of fighter jets that you had flown through your career, and it takes some time to get through all of them. Can I ask you a little bit about that? Because I don't think fighter jets have been as much in the news in recent years as much as they have been in the last week. First of all, the suggestion that European nations and possibly Canada are going to look at US purchases of fighter jets, F-16s, F-35s, and see is there an alternative. From your perspective, having flown all of these things, is there a realistic alternative to American military fighter jets anywhere else in the world?
Well, if you're going to spend a lot of money, you should shop around. That's just basic good practice. Everybody does that. And fighters, fighter airplanes, fighter jets, as you call them, sounds like a dinky toy, but it's funny. fighter aircraft are expensive things. You know, to defend your country in a high tech world is expensive. And Canada made the extremely long, slow, arduous decision to buy F-18s back in the late 70s and early 80s. And I was one of Canada's first F-18 pilots. But that was a long time ago, and those F-18s are of a different vintage. They're great airplanes, but they're not particularly stealthy from radar, and they're getting tired. The airframes are high time, and so we need to buy new ones. And then the question is, who do you buy them from? And obviously, with our extensive border and 150-year peaceful and productive mutual relationship with the United States, it makes sense for us to buy something like that from the U.S. And if shared common equipment, too, because we're both members of NATO, we're both members of NORAD. I mean, I was a NORAD fighter pilot intercepting Soviet bombers off the coast of North America. And so it makes sense to have common equipment if you can. But if one of the two countries is going to start a trade war, then you want to look closer at everything, including where you ship your electricity and where you sell your eggs and which fighter airplanes you buy.
How are you finding that? Because for somebody who spent so long in NASA, who was in the States, in Texas for so long, for somebody who was part of the NORAD Common Defense, What do you make of the way relations have gone? In it feels like the last few years, but the last few months.
Oh no, it's definitely been the last few months. In fact, the last few weeks. I think, like all Canadians, I am immensely disappointed and angered and patriotic. And you see it right across the country now. You see it in people's choices. And you see it in the words of our new prime minister. So I feel much like most Canadians.
But it's funny, I was watching a video of Mark Carney and Mike Myers together as a sort of a promotional piece in respect of Canada. And where the video finished was Carney reassuring Mike Myers that there would always be a Canada. It seems bizarre that the prime minister has been brought to a position where he has to guarantee people that the nation will continue to exist.
Well, it's sort of like you said, when your space station starts spewing liquid ammonia or loses all its power, it's easy to be panicked and scared if you don't know what you're doing. And you really want strong leadership. That's why you need a commander. That's why you need someone who has done the work, someone who has had high levels of responsibility, someone who understands the ramifications of what's going on. And, you know, you're not leading the country and you don't understand all the issues. You're just a Canadian, you know? So it's nice to have the person in the most senior leadership position in the land know what they're saying and be reassuring and be clearly, calmly, definitively reassuring. And so I think it's just that's a very entertaining commercial. And Mike Myers, I know both the men, and Mike Myers is great. And putting it into a hockey context is very Canadian. I think it was a very clever and effective commercial.
And do you think what do you think are the implications likely to be in relation to the kind of partnerships that you would have been part of? Because the kind of role that you had, NORAD as one, NASA as the other, are those, when you talk to your former colleagues, are they optimistic that normality will continue or will return?
Well, optimistic is sort of a way of living. I was also a pilot in the U.S. Air Force and the U.S. Navy on exchange while I was a pilot in the Royal Canadian Air Force. And that continues now. There are lots of European pilots and American pilots who are flying within the Royal Canadian Air Force and with the Army and the Navy. That's just common. Allies work together. And we have hundreds of years of peaceful cooperation, and it's been to our mutual benefit. But politics come and go, and we need to be respected. We need to retain our own sovereignty, and we need to get to the negotiating table and actually see what people's fundamental motivations are and try and do what's best for everybody as much as we possibly can. So, there is a tremendous amount of good inertia between the two countries and structures. And so optimism, I'm not sure. Optimism is a good way to go through life, because if you're pessimistic, then you kind of have a sour life. But optimism takes work. Optimism takes constant attention to the goodness and to work really hard on making, like, it's easy to be an optimistic fighter pilot, because you know what you're doing, and by having the ability to defend yourself, you can continue to maintain peace. And so, I'm optimistic, but it sure isn't going to be easy. And if there's going to be a trade war between two countries, that's going to do neither of them any good. But it's really just a tactic. And so it's a matter of keeping the eye on the long-term prize and recognizing that that there's a reason that politicians only have a four-year term.
A lot of questions coming in about the nature of the impact of spending 9 months in the space station on the astronauts who were doing it. I was reading that one of the big issues is a loss of bone density as well as muscle atrophy. Did you find any of that? Were any of your missions long enough for you to have a physical effect?
I flew in space 3 times, Anton, and my third one was a little under half a year. So I've been around the world 2,650 times, and every second of it weightless. And when you're weightless, your body tries to adapt. It's as if you suddenly lay in the most comfortable bed in the world and didn't even have to raise a finger for 6 months. Your body gets very lazy and it stops building bone because you don't need to have this construction skeleton underneath to hold your flesh and bone up, your flesh and your head up, you know, and so you start to lose bone, and a lot of the muscle that you use on a daily basis just to hold your head up and to stand and to walk, those will sort of waste away. And your balance system, of course, completely readapts because there's no gravity. Your heart shrinks because it doesn't have to lift your blood from the tip of your toes all the way up to the top of your head. For 6 months, your heart has a really easy go of it because it doesn't have to, if you imagine a little conveyor belt lifting the weight of your blood all the way up to the top of your head, and suddenly you didn't have that weight. So all of those things sort of plastically adapt to living on board the spaceship. And when you return, then obviously gravity is going to be a unrelenting master or an unrelenting grind of some enormous heel pushing you down into the dirt. But in order to combat it, we exercise 2 hours a day on the space station with resistive exercise and a stationary bicycle. We even have a treadmill with big elastic bungees that hold you onto the treadmill so you can run. So I returned to Earth actually slightly more fit than I took off, because excellent food, 2 hours of healthy food, no Guinness, no chips, nothing fried, you know, great, good food. But I returned less fat, more muscle, but I had lost some of the bone density in the areas that the equipment can't exercise. So my hips specifically and my upper legs, the bone in there, the femur, they were significantly less dense. They were porous, you know, osteoporosis at about 8% in my case. Wow. And we've had 2 astronauts within a month of getting back who have tripped and fallen and broken their hip, just because their hips are more fragile. And it takes a while for your body, bone takes a while to grow and to densify. And it's the outer, you know, sort of calcified bone, the inner trabecular bone, the sort of the soft and the hard part of a bone. It takes a while to get back to its pre-launch balance.
And without wishing to ask too personal a question, how are your hips now, Chris?
I'm not much of a dancer, but my hips are fine. Thank you. These hips don't lie. It took about 3 times. So if you're in space like Sonny and Butch were for 9 months, it'll take about 27 months for their bones to get back to pre-launch density. But both of them, and all astronauts would agree, it's infinitely worth it to go have the most magnificent of human experiences right on the cutting edge of what we're capable of doing and being some of the earliest direct explorers of the universe. So you have a little rehab afterwards. So what? It's what we dream of. It's what we work our entire adult lives towards. And it's what our lives of service entail. So they got some recovering to do, but they're both strong, healthy people and they'll be fine.
Chris, always a pleasure. Thank you so much. That is Commander Chris Hadfield.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.